Good morning, and welcome to the first panel of the next two, 3 days sessions on ethics and information security and privacy research, and a very happy new year to all of you here as well. My name is Rahul Talang, and I'm a professor of information systems and management at Carnegie Mellon University. I am an applied economist by training and do a lot of work related to security and privacy. And on the panel, I'm joined by three eminent scholars who I'll introduce shortly. But before I do that, I just wanted to kind of set an agenda and give you some sense of where we had some plans about how we are going to proceed. And then we'll start, let our panelists chime in. I think since morning, what we have heard many times over is that, you know, the information security and privacy is increasingly becoming interdisciplinary. And that just means that the computer scientists and engineers are increasingly now working with humans or machines purportedly run by humans. And as soon as we start doing that, I think immediately all the questions surrounding ethics become very relevant and important. And I'm sure many of you in this room, through your research, through your design, through your experiments, probably have thought about it. Maybe almost all of us probably have dealt with our university lawyers and IRBs, sometimes frustratingly. Probably most of us have some sort of NSF grants, and you know, many times the NSF grants require us to have either an IRB approval or some sort of an ethical declaration. And I think one thing we all probably will agree, that even though the idea of ethics has been around for a long time, the boundaries of what is ethical and what is not is quite gray. And I think I'll give you an example that I think all of you would have read about, the story on the Facebook research that basically came out a couple of months ago. So the researchers, in collaboration with Facebook, ran this experiment where they manipulated what they call as the news feed. So some, you know, randomly selected user were exposed to more positive news, whereas the other randomly selected users were exposed to more negative news feeds. And they wanted to measure whether does it have an effect on our emotional outcomes. You know, the word used in social science being the emotional contagion. And, you know, obviously they found, you know, all the positive results. However, I think many of you probably are well aware that that research caused, you know, a fair bit of brouhaha. I just wanted to point out that that research was actually published in PNAS, which is one of the leading and highly reputed outlet. So presumably the editors and the reviewers, at least at that time, did not think that there was anything to worry about the research that is being published. It was done in collaboration with Facebook, which clearly would not like any adverse negative publicity, has probably all sort of lawyers who would have gone through the detail of the research and every word that is being written. And everything was clear as far as the legal, the space was concerned. However, many people thought that that research crossed ethical boundaries. That is, people were exposed to different, manipulated into receiving positive versus negative news feed without their explicit consent, even though as soon as we start using Facebook, we have consented to pretty much everything and anything according to Facebook. So despite all of this, despite that, you know, social science has been dealing with ethical issues for a while, we still run into, you know, all these challenges where we question about whether this should have been done or this should not have been done, and what the implications of all of this is. And at the same time, as we all would agree that we are trading off at some level some sort of a scientific discovery or breakthrough that is going to come about with the research from the potential harm to the end user. And sometimes maybe we genuinely disagree about both the harm as well as the benefit. And, you know, some people may disagree. In fact, many people probably think that in the Facebook study, the eventual harm that was caused to the end user was, you know, minimal and not beyond what typically one would encounter typically on any kind of internet experience that you would go through. And, you know, we end up reaching, I guess, different conclusion. There is also this issue that there are various stakeholders involved. There is obviously researchers who have their own incentives. There are end users who are part of their experiment sometimes. But sometimes there are these third parties. You know, the firms like the Facebooks or Symantec or the Googles, or maybe some other researcher who might have collected data and is willing to share the data for analysis with some other researcher. And that data might have come from what we would consider as maybe questionable means, and now the question becomes then, you know, what do you do with the data? And how do you go about dealing with the data? The other instance of that is that if we become too strict about our ethical standards, then do we worry about that many of the firms, like in this example, Facebook, would actually stop collaborating with the researcher? So they will keep doing all the experiments they do for their own internal learning and make their policies and make their business decisions, just that they would not be willing to publish those results. They would not be willing to partner with researchers. They would not be willing to be transparent about what they did. So we haven't saved the user from any of the manipulation, but at the same time, we have basically precluded ourselves from getting this research out in the public because we are overly sometimes concerned about what the ethics surrounding those research might be. One unique aspect, and I think our panelists will probably talk more about it, of security and privacy research has been that many of us actually want to study sometimes some illicit behavior that's being carried out onto the internet. So whether it's people spending spam or running botnets or malware intrusion, and immediately you can imagine that as soon as you start designing a study thinking about those issues, I think lots of ethical as well as the legal issues are going to become extremely important. Information disclosure is also another important issue, whether it's a vulnerability disclosure, whether creating algorithm which might reveal user's identity, and even though the individual researcher is not interested in misusing that information, there's always some possibility that somebody else could probably misuse some of those as well. So the bottom line is, I think there are lots of gray areas. There is a, probably lack of agreement on what we would consider to be the right research design versus not so right research design. And hopefully this panel will actually highlight some of those issues and maybe think about a framework as we go forward toward what we consider as, highly eclectic, interdisciplinary cybersecurity research. And kind of set some norms about what would be what, as a reviewers and as authors, what we would consider to be an acceptable ethical and legal standard. Okay, so now I'm joined here by three eminent scholars. I think they are all well known, and most of you probably know them. My extreme left, we have Michael Bailey. Michael is an associate professor at UIUC, University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He was at Michigan before that and has done extensive work on system security, but more importantly, he has actually written extensively about the ethics in information security and privacy space. Then we have Lugo Bauer, who is also an associate professor in the Department of Electrical and Computer Engineering at Carnegie Mellon University. He has also done some very interesting work on human subject experiment. More importantly, he has done some really fascinating work on users' password use and collecting the data about the password, which is going to be directly relevant to some of the discussion we are going to have. And then finally, we have Stefan Savage, who is a professor in systems and networking group at UCSD. I think Stefan has done a lot of work on passively observing some of those illicit activity that I was talking about. And he'll be able to tell us how he went through all the loopholes and what's his viewpoint, views about some of those monitoring activities or measurement activities are. So the format of the panel that we agreed on was that I'll go over some questions with the panelists. Hopefully they will disagree on most of them. But I'm hoping that, we will have enough time in the end where all of you would be able to either ask questions or provide some commentary on some of the fundamental issues that we're talking about. Hopefully it'll be fun for everybody and we'll all be better off. Okay, so I'll just start with the first question and I'll ask Michael. So So the issue of ethics has been around us, you know, for a while, obviously. You know, we have this whole history of in the health and the behavioral sciences, you know, 1979 Belmont Report, which clearly codified what are the some fundamental principles of ethics is. I think my question is that, is there something unique about security and privacy that we require those fundamental principles, those codes, to be either tweaked in some ways? Or is it just that maybe a lot of computer scientists and engineers are not exposed to, you know, the training of ethics when they're doing their PhDs or postdocs, or there is something more to it? So I'll start with Michael and then let the other panelists comment as well.
Sure. So I think I think it's absolutely the case that we as a community lack a great deal of formal training or experience in dealing with ethical issues. But I'm going to push that aside and answer the first question. I think the question about whether or not there are unique issues, unique ethical issues in security and privacy happens in the backdrop of a long history and debate as to whether or not there are unique ethical issues in computers in general. And there's two different schools of thought here, and of course they are, yes, there are unique ones, and no, there aren't. I'm in the latter category. I think that, in fact, what computers, and in particular what security and privacy force us to do is think about existing ethical issues that happen in other contexts in different ways. So not necessarily unique. I don't think the idea, for example, of individual privacy or property rights are things that we haven't thought of before, but they're re-envisioned in new scale and a new context when we think about security and privacy. So those of you who are interested in this particular question, there's a chapter in the companion to the Menwell Report which lists out for that set of authors that worked through this issue what we thought some of the interesting some of the interesting properties of information technology research and security and privacy research that stretched our existing ethical thinking. And so obviously one of these things is scale. We're talking about being able to perform experiments now at an unprecedented scale. So going back to this comment about the Facebook, they did choose a small subset of the Facebook users to perform the study on. There's absolutely nothing that prevented them from doing that for the entire population of Facebook. And that's certainly performing that kind of experimentation at a scale that is much more representative than any of the sub-sampled populations that we would have seen. I think there's issues about separation of what's being studied and the complex systems that are being studied themselves. So the internet is a complex mechanism that consists of many different parts. So you could say that the design of your experiment was to only study BGP, and that should there be a failure, that should only infect the control plane. But of course we know that the control plane is connected very importantly to the data plane. So if you make a mistake in a BGP experiment, you're impacting the connectivity of a large number of individuals. I think another interesting area, and I'll stop after this one to let other panelists chime in, is this indirection. Oftentimes, it's hard to find the human subjects in the systems that we're measuring. So when you're talking about a traditional human subject experiment, say, for example, a medical experiment, this is a patient in the room. When you're doing informed consent, they're signing a document in your office with pen and paper. If you're talking about an experiment, say, for example, like the Facebook experiment, those people aren't anywhere near you. You're not physically present at all. And that's an easy version. Think, for example, of doing network traffic analysis, where you have a packet tap and an ISP, and you're looking at the flows of individual users. You know, sometimes those are sensitive flows, sometimes those are machine flows, and then the artifact of a complex distributed system. So I think, again, these issues exist in other contexts, but they get stretched to an extreme when they're considered security and privacy research.
Sure. So I agree. Fortunately or not, that the fundamental ethical issues are the same. I think that there are practical issues having to do again with computer systems rather than security and privacy that do make things quite different sometimes. So one of them is that our understanding of what's ethical and what's not is just less clear in the online domain in computer systems than it is in the physical world. So an example is, I think we would all probably agree that something like copying music when all music was on DVDs or tape or whatever was not ethical, in addition to not being legal, right? And then suddenly in computer systems we had Napster, and it, for some reason, it became a lot less clear to many people whether this was an ethical behavior or not, right? And so similarly, we have behaviors that experimenters might engage in, which at one point in some other domain would clearly have been unethical, and then in the computer systems domain maybe suddenly it's unclear, right? And part of it is also this distance between the experimenter and the subject that often exists, as Michael talked about. I think another practical issue that often comes up is that the domain is very complex, and so that impacts the ability not only of the experimenters but also of IRB members to judge whether an experiment is ethical. And I think that for more traditional sorts of experiments, an institutional review board is very likely to be able to come to a decision pretty easily about whether or not an experiment is ethical, right? And it's unlikely that the experimenters will be able to accidentally or purposefully sneak something past the IRB. Versus in computer systems, I think this happens all the time. The people who are reviewing the ethics of experiments don't understand the technology well enough to really understand all the impacts, all the consequences of the experiments. And so to a greater degree than in other fields, I think it's up to the experimenters to be making the right ethical choices. Because if they don't, they do have the ability to trick the IRB into approving the experiment in most cases.
Sure. So I'm just going to add one or two points, because I think I agree with most of what was said. I think the core thing that separates, creates more gray area in our domain than, for example, in biomedical research, comes down to the fact that we don't have a really great way of agreeing about harm. And some of that has to do with the fact that it's very clear when you're talking about medicine what harm means, right? When people have negative physical side effects, whereas the kinds of harms that we deal with online are far more indirect and far more amorphous. And the rate as well at which we can create new experiments and new kinds of experiments is so much greater than what goes on in biomedicine, where there have been decades in which to solidify a way of thinking about these problems, where we get faced with a new kind of ethical question appearing in our field on a weekly basis. And then the other thing is that biomedical work is regulated, both in industry and in academia. And we have this very strange situation in the ICT world where there is a huge amount of work going on that is in fact dealing directly with the same subject matter, with people manipulating them in various ways for commercial benefit, that we do not regulate because it's commerce. And the lines between the industrial world and the research world in internet and security research are quite thin. And so this notion that, well, over on this side of the fence, Facebook and Microsoft and Google can do all of these kinds of things, but then as soon as we put a research label on it, then it becomes bad, is very difficult for people to understand. And so I think teasing apart all of that is part of what makes this quite complicated.
Okay, so that sets up nicely for the next point, which is, and this may be more general and not specific to security privacy, though it happens quite a bit, that is, so the data is collected by a third party. You know, it could be a firm, it could be a researcher, it could even be a hacker. And that data is made public sometimes, or the researcher wants to work with you, or the hacker is willing to share the data with you. And you can actually do something really interesting. I think maybe Karna botnet would be an example where, you know, the whole thing was mapped, you could question the legality of it completely, but now that the data is public and, you know, you can do something really, really interesting, and now the question is that, well, that should we go that route? Should it even be considered ethical? And again, I can take even more subtle example where, you know, the Facebook story that I mentioned, where you could imagine that the researcher could say, well, everything was done by Facebook, internally reviewed. I was just given the data to do the analysis, so I don't have to go to my IRB to do any approval because I did not do that experiment. I am just doing the data analysis. So there are these various ways, you know, when you have this third party involved where the attribution can, you can hide behind those attribution, and I think the question is that, you know, where do you draw the line? I mean, is it case by case basis, or is it something, you know, something more fundamental? And I'll start with maybe Luo.
Sure. Okay. So to me, this is a very interesting issue. Partly because it's one aspect of it is what got me thinking most about ethics in experiments with human subjects first. So my history with this is that for a number of years, maybe 5 or 6 years now, we've been doing at Carnegie Mellon a bunch of password research. And as part of this research, one of the things we do is we see what passwords have been leaked and are publicly available on the internet, and we use these as training data, and as for comparison purposes, we can compare them to other passwords. And when we started doing this, it sort of seemed a no-brainer to go out on the web, see, you know, find the millions and tens of millions of passwords that have been leaked and use them in our research. And only afterwards did we start thinking about whether this was ethically okay, right? Because it is clearly the case that for many of these, most of these passwords, that they were stolen. That is, the people to whom the passwords belonged did not agree to the fact that these passwords were being made public, and they certainly did not agree to the uses that we were going to make of them, even if these uses we thought were fairly benign. So our reasoning about the ethics of this sort of happened after the fact, and I guess perhaps in a biased way, we concluded that our use of these passwords was in fact okay. But I think in this case, as in every other case, it does have to be a judgment call where we consider the balance between the harms caused to users and the potential benefits to society. And in particular, one of the harms that we would be worried about in a case like this is whether our use of the data that has already been stolen, so the fact that we're using it after the fact is not influencing the creation of this particular data, but our use of the data could influence the creation of future data sets of a similar kind, right? So by using the data and perhaps doing something running an experiment which gets some publicity, we might be encouraging somebody else to conduct a similar attack, or again leak another bunch of passwords. So, in our judgment, in this particular case, we thought that it was very unlikely that we would be encouraging additional harms to happen, and we thought that there were some fairly reasonable, tangible benefits to society as a result of us doing the research. I think the other thing I'll mention here is that when trying to make this judgment call, where we weigh the risks to people and compare them to the benefits of the experiment, I think it's really important to keep in mind what the concrete benefits are versus what the hypothetical hoped for benefits are. Right? So sometimes we do experiments where we know that the outcome of the experiment will be something useful no matter what the outcome turns out to be. Right? And other times we go fishing and we hope we find something interesting. Right? And potentially if we find something really interesting, the benefit is great. But there's also the potential that we'll find nothing. Right? And I think it's very important to distinguish between these two kinds of benefits, right? The ones that we think, the experiments that we think will definitely have benefits no matter what, and the experiments that have the chance to have benefits but also might not.
You used the word our judgment. I just wanted to make, was it just the judgment that you researcher, or was IRB or CMU lawyers or some other folks were involved as well?
So maybe this partly goes back to my previous comments that I think in the kinds of experiments that we do, often it is the experimenters who are the most expert, and will. I think it's upon us to be responsible for making the judgment of whether something is ethical or not, independently of the IRB. So everything we've done was vetted by the IRB, but this reasoning was on the part of the experimenters.
Okay.
So this is one of those questions where I think there are people who come, you know, reasonable people who come to different conclusions. And I think part of the reason is that all of us really have multiple ethical systems at work at the same time. Right, so to frame two of them that I think are familiar with everyone, one is utilitarianism, which was pretty much described just now. Just look there, I'm going to try to quantify or come up with some sense of what harms are and what benefits are, and I'm going to weigh them and say, look, if benefits are more than harms, then this was a reasonable thing to do because I'm maximizing overall utility. Another, I think, very familiar school of thought is deontology, that there are some things that are just good on their face and just bad on their face, and if you do the bad thing, it doesn't matter what the benefits are, that it's insurmountable, that act can never lead to an ethical outcome. And so this is, you know, Do we use experiments done by the Nazis for medical research? Well, you know, it is so egregious that we are uncomfortable considering that there could be any benefit coming from this. And I think the Carnot botnet, and for those of you who aren't familiar, the Carnot botnet was a piece of contagious malware that took over a huge number of cable modem routers and then put together what is, I think, pretty much without doubt, the highest fidelity map of the internet in existence, and then distributed the research result via BitTorrent. All right, and I don't think there's any debate that what was done was illegal and unethical. All right, I don't think there's any debate about that. Then the question comes to us, there is this BitTorrent out there that has the best picture of the internet around. Do we use it in our research or not? And this is a place where I think people disagree. I think, for example, Mike and I disagree on this one. I think Mike feels queasy about using it. On the other hand, I think he would also admit that the research community has spoken in the form of citations, which at last count were like 15 or 20 papers that we've published that have used the Carnot botnet results in research and growing. And I don't know that there's a crisp answer to this question other than the one of figuring out where you stand on the particular issue and then deciding if it's too hard to touch, and then how does the community come out in general on the utilitarian versus deontological question. And I don't think there's a crisper solution than that.
Maybe Michael has.
No. Yeah, if you're looking for engraved tablets, I left them at home. It's going to be entirely unsatisfying if you're going to look for rules. I'm definitely a utilitarian consequentialist, so I balance harms and benefits. A couple things from the points that were come up earlier. I would say that in addition to your actual very first point, it's not just in that particular mode of operation that we lack good metrics for harms. I think we actually don't have great metrics for benefits either. So we often say, you know, the benefit of this work is science. And, I have the T-shirt too, and science is awesome. But, you need to be a little bit more specific than that if you're going to balance that against actual harms.
Six units of science.
Six units of science? Outstanding. Is that metric units of science? Or?
You're in the imperial system here.
Exactly. So I think every one of these things, back to the original question, is going to be a judgment call. I think some of the case studies that came up are great for sort of teasing out the various components that go into a judgment call like that. So we've made a comment about your password studies, and I would say that that was ethical. We talked about Carnot botnet. I would say that that's not ethical. And then we talk about, you brought up Snowden. Mm-hmm. And I would have said that, actually, you brought up WikiLeaks, so let's use that one instead. So you brought up WikiLeaks, and I would have said that that was ethical, in my personal opinion. And so let me give you a reason.
The leaking or the using?
Well, it was illegal but ethical, let's put it that way. So Leaking was clearly illegal, but I think that whole action might have, one could reasonably argue that that was ethical. So let me give you why I think those are interesting points in a space. And again, that's my personal opinion. So one, which is actually gets to harms. So we brought up this issue of, if you're doing utilitarian consequentialism, you're balancing benefits and harms. And so I think you asked precisely the right question with the password reuse study, which is, would the use or legitimizing in some way by publishing the password studies have it resulted in more people stealing more passwords? And I think the answer to that is no. They were stealing the passwords anyway. The passwords were an artifact of some other activity. They're going to continue to steal passwords at the same rate they were stealing passwords before. And they're going to continue to leak them at the same rate they were doing it before.
But maybe now you've communicated how easy it is to crack passwords because 123456 is so popular, and now more people
sure.
will do it.
Sure, but I think that's an ethical issue about whether you do the research as opposed to whether or not the using the found data was...
Right.
In the case of Karno, this was clearly somebody, if you read the blogs, right, this is somebody's science experiment. Somebody was piqued by curiosity. There was no other reason other than they wanted to see whether it could be done, and they went out and did it. And I think in those particular situations, you do actually run the risk of legitimizing it, because the person basically said this is a glorified, you know, high school or college science experiment. And they went out and ran it, and here's what the result. And so I think there the risk, the harm, actually is much greater than the harm that you talk about in the password reuse studies. You go to something else like WikiLeaks, where you know, you're violating all kinds of ridiculous laws in order to leak the data, but then now you're balancing something on the benefit side. So you're making assessments of what's the relative value of having, for example, a more accurate map, and how accurate is this map compared to the map that John Heidemann makes at ISI? And you know, how much incremental value is there in doing something like this versus you know, what could be argued to be threats that undermine the core values of democracy? So you know, you're making a different balancing act there. At least I'm making a personal judgment and balancing act when I think about balancing the ethics of those particular activities.
So I think an important thing to point out, and I think Mike gave a great example, is that these decisions are not culturally objective, and we shouldn't pretend that they are. All right. So right there, Mike was saying, all right, we want to uphold the values of democracy, and so this is why it's okay. And this is also why our community has decided it's totally okay for us to do research on pushing Tor relays in China so that people can get around the government's interest in censoring information, because we believe that it's okay to do that and that the Chinese government believes otherwise is wrong, and hence they are unethical and we are ethical. And I think that's a fine decision to make, but I think it would be a mistake for us to pretend that we are objective in this and that there is some higher ethical principle to which we ascribe.
Okay. A lot of time the legitimacy to the research is provided by our journals, and I'll come to that shortly. So this is directly relevant to some of the work, Stefan, you have done, which is about passively measuring some outcomes. And you know, sometimes those outcomes could be some sort of illicit activity, whether it is a spam measurement or botnet or malware. And you know, clearly the researchers have the capability to, you know, measure these things, and those measurements are really important, because you know, otherwise you get all these bizarre numbers that, you know, spam is $1 trillion worth of, you know, business, and because nobody has measured anything, so you're always coming up with pulling the numbers from the vacuum. So I had two sets of questions. One is that, what are the legal ethical considerations? You know, you yourself has done this, so you probably have some insights about it. And I think the second part of the question is that, even though you're doing some passive measurement and you actually see some harm being done to the machine that you're measuring or you're passively observing, is there some now ethical responsibility as a researcher to either inform the user or do something so that you know the harm is not now committed? So even though you are just passive observer, the mere fact that there is something going on which is harmful to the machine or the user who is holding the machine, you know, where do those boundaries lie? And I think this is, I think, again, probably a little...
I'll try. So, you know, is the second part really goes to a question of, you know, should there be a Good Samaritan law for internet research? And I would say that I'm not a fan of codifying this in a way that says thou must. Because the operational, practical reality, having done some of it, is that the amount of work required to do notification when you are operating at scale is enormous. There are some domains now where there are organizations who will help you. So if you need to repatriate, you know, a million credit cards. There are people you can go to who will help you do that. If you need to inform 20 million people that their machines are infected, good luck. Because you don't have their identifiers, you have their IP addresses. And so now there are, for people who do get in, access to this kind of information, there are a whole bunch of third-party organizations who will accept this data and do ISP notification and so forth. And so there are ways in which you can pass this along without owning the problem yourself. I would say I admire people when they do it, and I feel good when I do it. I wouldn't want to have to do it every single time I encounter it. I would never get anything done. As to the earlier question, there is this one other funny thing that's different about ethics in the security world is that we sometimes deal with the ethical questions of dealing with an adversary. And so this issue about what are my responsibilities to a third-party human subject who is attacking me don't have good analogs in the other kinds of ethics that we've previously thought about. So if someone is trying to infect my machine, can I do experiments on them? All right? And by and large, the community has voted with its feet that yes, you can. Now, there is a big difference between ethics and law. And I think Mike started to outline some of those. In the United States, there are a whole bunch of, I mean, so as soon as you start touching anyone else's machine, you have the issue of CFAA, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act. When you're passively listening, there's ECPA, which is the Electronic Communications Privacy Act. There's a ton of rat holes one can fall into here. Reverse engineering software, you have DMCA risk. So there's a lot of stuff. What we do is we have a lawyer that we pay. That's ours, and then we have general counsel sign off, and we spend a lot of time before doing any of these things going through, and there is no lawyer on this planet who will tell you, yeah, it's okay. What they will tell you is, I think this is an acceptable risk profile for the university, or no, don't do that, please. And that's and part of that is because our law is very general, and there's a lot of gray area here as well. I mean, by the letter of ECPA, in a multi-party consent state, you can't look at web logs. In the state of California, by the letter of the law, if you look at your own web server's logs without obtaining consent from everyone who visits the website, you can read the law to say that that was actually a criminal act. And this is unfortunately not shown. When I reverse engineer a piece of software, I am maybe committing a DMCA violation. And so, you know, this is one of those things where you just have to be very careful. But that's a separate issue from whether or not it's ethical. You can have stuff that's illegal and totally ethical, as Mike said, and you can have stuff that's totally ethical and quite illegal.
A lot of time, at least in the medical and the social science world, without user consent, you don't do anything.
In all of those worlds, you have you can get IRB approval for consentless studies. Usually you have to demonstrate why you need that, why the benefits are more significant, why the harms will be controlled. And then the one place where there's a more significant difference is that when you're dealing onesie-twosie with individuals, almost always there is an obligation to inform people at the end if they have been deceived.
Right.
And that is challenging to do when you have 40 million people under test. And so the notification happens much less in our world than it does in those other communities.
Yeah, so good. We can disagree about something else. So I totally agree with you with respect to this difference between ethics and law, and it should be absolutely clear. I think that everybody on the panel is talking about ethics today. We're not lawyers. There's a big difference between what's legal and what's ethical. So we're just talking about what's ethical. But I absolutely believe that we as researchers have an obligation to do the notifications. So I don't want to have a law or a hard and fast rule, because I think there's a huge difference, for example, in notifying the FBI about some criminal activity and notifying an ISP that they're running a vulnerable piece of software. I think those activities are different activities. They have different risk profiles. They have different success rates. So I wouldn't want to have some hard and fast rule, because then somebody would start to apply those in the situational places and inappropriately. But I think if you look at, for example, the concept of benefits, which is codifying this utilitarian approach in the US IRB system, it doesn't say just do something good. It says maximize the benefits to the population out of the activity that you're doing. So I do think we have an active obligation to do more than just, if we see an opportunity, we have an obligation to do more than just fulfill the science obligation that we had as part of the IRB. We do have to go that extra step. Otherwise, we have this long-term risk of breaching the public's trust when they come to discover that, you know, we were in possession of this information, we could have done something to prevent a downstream harm, but simply chose not to do it. I skipped ahead of you.
No, that's good. I wanted you to go before me. Yeah. So, for me, this question is much easier, because when I talk about experiments at scale, they have 5,000 people in them, not 20 million or tens of millions. I very much agree with Michael that I think it's the responsibility of the researchers to disclose the discovered potential harms to subjects. Part of this question that was previously raised was, well, what happens if you're in the situation where disclosing this information to participants would invalidate your experiment? And I would argue that that's not a particularly good reason to not disclose to participants, right? There are many, many reasons why experiments fail, and one of the reasons they fail is that we might have designed them in such a way that an ethical behavior that we need to take during the experiment also invalidates the experiment, right? So to me, all that means is that we should try hard when we're designing our experiment to structure it in such a way that we get valuable data, even in the case that we have to exclude some subjects or many subjects due to notification like this. I want to make one more point following up on what Stefan said. I think a couple of times you mentioned the community voting with its feet and that being sort of a statement of the community about the ethics of a particular behavior. I think I would challenge that. I think that there are cases when the community has considered the ethical implications and decided that something is ethically okay, but I feel like there are also many other cases in which the program committee that accepted a paper which might have ethical challenges simply hasn't considered the ethical issues, or the people who on the committee who have considered the ethical issues weren't particularly well informed about the subject. And so I feel like even in situations when it seems like the community has decided that something is ethical by virtue of accepting a bunch of papers that perform this activity, I think it's still incumbent upon every future program committee to reconsider the ethical issues and make sure that they in fact have been treated correctly.
So I actually completely agree on this, and this is, I think, a great segue to another point that was coming up, which is what's the responsibility of the community with respect to this, and journals and conferences and so forth. And you know, ethics is this very strange domain, which is really one of a community standard. We don't have these tablets from on high that Mike forgot to bring. And so absent that, really it's the set of people in the room who are voting their conscience and what logic tells them about whether work is passes ethical muster for them or not. And this changes over time, in fact. We have work that, you know, 10 years ago we would have said, you know, no, you can't do that, that now is actually quite common. And the challenge is, in fact, what is the best way to kind of poll the community and figure out where people land on this? And we don't have a best way, and so the only way we have that exists is the form of program committee paper review. And I would say that there has been a change. Traditionally, I think program committees have not wanted to consider ethics among the set of things that they consider. They don't like it, they find it icky, They don't want to reject a colleague's paper because it's unethical, it carries a stigma, they feel they're not properly trained, all kinds of reasons why they don't want to touch it. And I think that, in fact, this is a buck that cannot be passed, and that this is going to be a responsibility, and has become one increasingly at peer review committees, that is one of the things that paper reviewers need to evaluate, because, in effect, the peer review committee does end up putting the stamp on one paper at one time. Each one is just a sample, but what the community feels about a given set of research at a point in time, and if they're not giving that signal back, then we have no one to blame but ourselves. And you start seeing this increasingly in calls for papers and conferences and journals where they ask people to be clear about their ethical standards and so forth. I think a mistake is there are some conferences that have wanted to farm it out and just say you need to get IRB approval and then use that as a checkbox. And IRB is totally separate from ethics. It overlaps, actually. It's not separate. It overlaps, but it is not the same thing. It's a compliance measure for dealing with human subjects. You can have ethical issues that have nothing to do with human subjects, and you can have stuff that passes IRB muster that I think our community would not accept. And so I think at the end, we have to take more and more responsibility for voting explicitly and then being as transparent as possible about those outcomes. The other thing that I think is unfortunate is that there have been papers that have been rejected for ethical reasons, and there have been papers that are accepted after a spirited discussion about the ethics, and that information remains locked in the heads of the sets of people who are either on the program committee or in the social circle that would allow them to know all of those things that are supposed to be confidential. And it really, we could use a lot more transparency about how the community feels about these topics so that people can act accordingly.
I mean, given the interdisciplinary nature, do we worry that it's going to get worse or going to get better? Because, you know, an engineer and a psychologist could completely disagree sometimes on what would be considered maybe acceptable or not, or even the harm or the benefit.
But why is that a problem?
Well, no. So would it lead to maybe more papers being rejected that maybe like a coherent stream like medical would have accepted, or would it lead to more people being accepted saying that, okay, you think it's okay, so let's get it in?
You know, I think if the community expands to include a broader set of people and that shifts how people feel in one way or the other, then that is in effect what's ethical. Now you could say, well, there are going to be different communities, and that's fine. Look, journalists, if you look at the journalist community, they do all kinds of things that we would, like pretexting is a great example. I'll go and lie to you in order to get information, and they'll say, yeah, that's okay. At least there's a big chunks of the journalism community that will say, that's totally fine. We would say, what are you talking about? You can't go and like lie to an NSF program manager and then like write that down as part of a study. That's not okay. And it's okay for different communities to have different standards, even in the same, around the same kind of work.
Yeah, I'm not going to disagree with anything.
So let me just get to one more last point before I open it up for questions, which is about the university IRB systems. Does anybody have any comments about, does it become like a shield sometimes so that we can do what we want to do versus like a truly a mechanism where hopefully something potentially unfavorable or unethical actually gets detected and corrected? Maybe I'll start with Michael.
So the ultimate responsibility for engaging in ethical research will always be with the investigator who started the research. There's just absolutely no way to get around it. Anybody who's looking for somebody else to tell them that it's okay to do what they're going to do and uses that as a shield is looking for trouble. I think given that this is an NSF PI meeting and that most of you are working with organizations that have received federal money, I think it's probably fair to say that for any of your human subjects, comma, research, it is necessary for you to do an IRB. You are required to do that by law. And if you don't do it, you jeopardize the funding for not just you, but your entire university. That being said, IRBs are, in many cases, necessary for human subjects research, but absolutely not sufficient. And simply having, as I think Seth alluded to earlier, an IRB approval does not mean that the community can no longer weigh in and say that we as a community find that this work to be acceptable or not acceptable. It's a compliance with the common rule, and I think you have to engage in it. I think when done right, an IRB serves as a useful foil for you to think about some of the ethical issues in the work that you're doing. But again, a necessary component of our human subjects work, but not necessarily sufficient.
I agree with all of that. I would just echo what Stefan said earlier about lack of transparency with respect to program committee discussion being an impediment to the community understanding ethical issues that have surrounded papers that have been accepted or rejected. And sometimes I think IRBs could benefit from similarly an increase in transparency. I think the fact that we have very little feedback from IRBs other than them saying okay or not okay means that often an investigator's approach might be to treat the submission to an IRB as a reason to go to a checklist of things that need to be satisfied before submitting the experiment design instead of going through the process of actually holistically thinking about the ethical implications. And if we were to get better feedback from the IRB, including some discussion about how they see the ethics of the experiment, that maybe would encourage the experimenters to think more broadly about the ethics of the experiment in the first place.
Maybe it's a good time to open this up for the audience and see whether people have some comments, questions for the panelists. So we have another 10 minutes, so maybe hopefully we can.
So I appreciate all the things you've said about legal and ethical being very separate things. The one thing that I'd like to get your comments on, it sounds like there's a sense that it's totally okay to do things that are illegal. And I'd like to understand what the ethics are as a PI for encouraging students to do things that are illegal, if that's still ethical.
So there's a bunch of different kinds of illegal, right? There's not crisply legal, okay? So again, I tell my students they can look at the web logs for our web server. Although under literal interpretation of federal law, it's illegal, all right? I tell them that it is okay for them to reverse engineer stuff, although we may have DMCA issues with doing that. And I don't have any people doing censorship research, but those who do are definitely doing things that are illegal under the laws of other countries that you know they're not living in. And so I think that there actually is a fair amount of stuff that gets done and is encouraged to be done that is not where we believe that the law is out of touch with where we stand. And you know, is that, I don't think we've gotten to the point where there's a slippery slope on this one, but I understand where the concern comes from.
So I think this is a space where reasonable people will differ. I have a stricter interpretation of it, which is that I think independently of ethical reasons, I don't want to encourage students to do illegal things. I think also in my research, I would try to follow a relatively strict legal standard. So for example, if I could do, and this happens pretty often, you know, we could do really cool research if we were to violate the terms of service of some service like Mechanical Turk. And if occasionally it happens that we accidentally violate the terms because we didn't read all the fine print, but if we become aware that a plan for an experiment is going to violate the terms of service, then we'll change the plan, even if it's much more painful for us or maybe prevents us from doing an experiment.
And I would agree with that.
Yeah, so there's a pretty big difference between ethics and normative ethics. And so don't take me arguing, for example, that WikiLeaks could be argued to be ethical to say that that's what everyone should go and do. I'm just arguing that a reasonable person could say that that was an ethical behavior. Certainly with respect to students and other PIs, I would never suggest somebody to go off and do something illegal. There are large and broad consequences for doing illegal things. And I will say, however, as an aside, to your own self be true. And so if you find that there is something that might cause you to do that, that's your own personal decision. It goes back to the comment I made earlier, is no amount of IRB, no amount of legal or illegal ever abdicates your personal responsibility to do the right thing, whatever that happens to be for you.
Thank you. That was a really interesting discussion. I'd like to come back to a point. I think Stefan made this a little bit. So in the commerce context, you know, like the Facebook example, the line between research and development and just doing your business is very blurry. And you know, all three of you talked about the experimenter and talked about human subjects research, but I think in the ICT context, human subjects interaction, you know, usually mediated by a network and very large scale, are sort of the currency that we do business with. And you know, so unlike in the medical scenario where there is the regulation, even in the commercial context, we don't have that regulation or as much regulation in the commercial context. But there are other examples of services provided to humans that also don't, education probably being a good example, where you know, you could view any change of curriculum that a teacher does in the classroom as in some sense an experiment. And so, you know, I think there's a broad question about sort of where does the ethics of, you know, Facebook's algorithm deciding what you get to see when it's not done in the context of an experiment get discussed, and the broader questions around that that we probably don't have time for, but I guess in the context of this meeting, you know, maybe the question is, when you have interactions between, you know, what's sort of more clearly being scoped as research for academics doing their work in the context of the university, who are working with people who are out there in the commercial realm and working in their own context, you know, what should be done? I mean, should we be looking at maybe more regulation, less regulation, you know, saying it'll just be unregulated and you know, does it just become a different responsibility for the academic participants than the industry participants? So I'd be interested in your perspectives.
So I think the challenge, let's see if I can unwind the question a little bit. So I think one of the challenges is that you can't finally separate these two things. I mean, like, all of our good students go to Google. Heck, you know, we have this problem in systems faculty. All the good systems faculty are going to Google, right? Because they're building the system that the world uses. And so if you're looking for interesting systems problems, clearly they have some of them. So it's hard to separate as cleanly the research versus not research, because really this is where all the action is. I'm not a big, some people, I cringed when you used the research, the regulation word, as evidenced by the body of law that governs networking research right now. You know, the government doesn't seem to do a very good job of creating laws that look out for its citizens' well-being and promote societal values. So I would be hesitant to go off and say, I mean, this is why we go back to this notion of community, which is, in the absence of federal or state law to govern this activity, we can do the best that we can as a community, come up with a set of, evolving set of community shared values, and hold members of the community accountable to those sets of values. Because I think that's the only thing that will stand up when we go to court or we go and have to fight with regulators to get a different policy enabled, to say, no, look, we've been doing this for 10 years. This is what the community of experts agree on, and this is what we think is right.
I think one aspect of this is somewhat similar to this, the prior discussion topic of working with stolen data. So sometimes we work with data that's provided by a company, and there, to me, the calculation is similar as it would be with stolen data. The fact that the data comes from somewhere else, I didn't generate it myself, doesn't mean that I'm not responsible for making the ethical decision if the data was obtained in a way that I believe is unethical with respect to the people from whom it was obtained. It doesn't matter who was doing the obtaining. To perhaps secondary question of when is it actually ethical for a company to do this or not, I won't pretend to try to give any kind of comprehensive answer, but I think one big part of it is related to meeting or violating users' expectations. So in the case of the Facebook experiment, for example, I've heard it argued, and I do believe that the main problem there was that Facebook users were being subjected to the experiment unknowingly, and there doesn't actually seem to be much reason for that experiment to have been conducted in such a way. Right? In that particular case, it seems like users could have been solicited to become part of the experiment and been told what the experiment would be about. And I'm pretty certain that the same results could have been obtained anyway. So in that case, I would argue, since the better way existed, then that way would have been more ethical.
So we heard a number of times that no one here has any tablets to give us, and that there are different ethical standards for different communities and the like. But it seems to me that if we follow that thought, we're going to end up with a race to the bottom like we've seen in journalism, where the person who is most willing to bend the rules gets the juiciest research. Is it not better for us to come up with an arbitrary and incorrect set of ethical standards and hold everyone to them?
No.
No? Why not? Elaborate.
I would argue that to some extent that's what we're doing now, right? Until we can solve this transparency issue, this is essentially what's happening, is that, you know, some subset of the community which is plugged into these issues are being vocal in some fraction of the PC meetings and axing some fraction of the papers for ethical grounds. And until that percolates down, either through the authors into the rest of the community, or we find some mechanism to be transparent, I won't say it's incorrect, I'd say it's completely ad hoc. And I think that all of us would like to see more transparency so that there was quicker communication of whatever those community values that we arrive at are. I mean, if we decide that, for example, when doing malware clustering analysis, that 10,000 malware samples is not a representative sample, we quickly learn that 100,000 is the new magic value. And so every experiment that next year will have 100,000 in each of the papers. It'd be nice if that kind of mechanism existed to be explicit and transparent, so that if we said, hey, look, these kinds of studies are not acceptable, they would just simply stop happening.
Yeah, so I wanted to return to this topic of the program committees policing these ethical standards with two questions that I've encountered several times. So one of them is, I understand you made the point that ethics and legal issues are kind of separate, but should it also be program committees' responsibilities to evaluate the legality of a piece of research before deciding whether it should be accepted or not, and if so, how that should play out, whose jurisdiction and so forth? And secondly, regarding the this point you just made, Michael, about sort of, you know, transparency and wouldn't it be nice if there were, or in some sense we're enforcing an arbitrary set of standards, I guess I would actually return to the previous questioner's point that because these standards are being applied in a fraction of the cases, a fraction of the time, a lot of precedent gets set for, because they slip through the cracks, of research being done that might fly in the face of certain people's ethical principles. And then we get the comments about the community having voted with its feet by publishing a lot of these papers. And so it becomes very hard in program committees to argue against that. I've been on the other side of these arguments where someone says, look, there are five papers already published that did exactly the same thing. How dare you question that this is ethical, right? And I really think it's not very practical for us to try to make the argument that you can fight against that groundswell of established published research. So now the question is, if we can't, what do we do about this to avoid the race to the bottom, right? How do we not go there?
So can you remind me what the first part of the question was again?
Oh, the legal question. So is that part of what a program committee
should do? So in my opinion, I don't think program committees are very well poised to deal with the legal issues. I think they have a responsibility to deal with the ethical questions. And at the end of the day, I think it's something that we need to, if we don't have expertise in enough to evaluate where our gut check is on different kinds of work, then we need to get it. The legal stuff is I think a level of expertise that we're not likely to get, and I don't think is the standard that we need to have. And then the legal where. I mean, there's a lot of questions about jurisdiction that I think don't really have any bearing on the research community. I don't have a crisp answer for the second part of your question. I think that my sense is that to the extent that people find things that have been done we're not okay, all right? That if people really feel that way, they do reverse themselves. You have not seen a lot of Tor exit node studies since the famous Tor exit node study, all right? And it was published, but there was a lot of discussion about that, and we don't see that anymore. I think, in fact, there has been quite a lot of shaping of how researchers do their work in response to the kinds of concerns people have had about other papers. And so I think it is true that there are some things where there have been a bunch of papers and people point at it, but I think in a lot of those cases, what's also true is that most of the other people in the room think that it's okay, and that you may be in the minority in not thinking it's okay. I think if the majority of people in the room really don't think it's okay, I think it is possible. I know you asked us to not make that argument, but I think it totally is possible to fight against it. I think if people don't agree with you or don't care, you know, that's the worst case, right? That they're just, you know, totally apathetic about the question, then yes, we have problems.
The only hope, at least I guess, is that in academia there is a whole long-term reputation that you have to build in, so hopefully nobody can get away with it consistently. Hopefully, I don't know, maybe one can.
I want to chime in a little bit, probably also not to your satisfaction, Mike, but I think on the legal versus ethical aspect of how program committees make the decisions, I agree completely that I don't really foresee a near-term future where PCs will be competent to make good legal judgments. I think that there might be cases when something is clearly illegal and therefore I would argue that it's unethical to accept the paper. But I think a big difference between the legal and the ethical dimensions is that there is a pretty good regulatory framework in place for punishing legal violations, and not much of a framework for punishing ethical violations. And therefore, I think it's much more important for us to be focusing on the ethical violations.
I don't want us to go too far over standards, so we have time for one more question from these five fairly quickie analysts, and then before the lunch gets to
lunch. Okay. I want to continue on this topic a little bit. I think it's very important for a community to decide its standards, and even more important for the community to make those standards well known and consistently applied. The fact that program committees, as you say, occasionally apply these standards, and every year it's a different program committee and some papers get through and some don't, is unfair and arguably unethical to the researchers whose papers are treated inappropriately according to the community standards. I just checked to see whether our call for papers actually say anything about human subjects or the standards that might be applied by our program committees. IEEE Security and Privacy says nothing. ACM CCS says nothing. USENIX Security has a really nice section on human subjects and what authors need to do in order to say disclose their treatment of human subjects, and it actually references something I don't think you've mentioned yet, which is a new ethics feedback panel for networking and security, which I gather is a community structured for discussing and determining our norms. And I would encourage the community to come up with a standard or a written set of norms that everyone understands.
So the challenge, I think that would be great if it's possible. I say the challenge with this, and this has been done as a thought exercise on a number of mailing lists, is that all of the action in the space tends to be in the gray areas, in the corner cases, which right. is precisely where it is almost impossible to write standards, because everything, new things are coming all the time. And if you write something that is all-encompassing, then it tends to be so generic as to be difficult to interpret. Like, do good things.
Like laws sometimes are.
Actually, before I ask my question, ACM actually does have a code of conduct that is pretty specific about that. And actually, at the CHI PC meeting, we rejected a paper on ethical grounds this year. But anyway, I just had a brief anecdote going back to the discussion about harm. Several years ago, I did a study, and the IRB wanted us to debrief participants a week afterwards. Since it was an online study, we wanted some time to make sure everyone had taken the study before we debriefed them. And, you know, because it was security related, there was deception involved. And we got a barrage of emails after we sent the debriefing email, because people were irate that they were deceived, even though, you know, that they weren't alleging any harm, they just didn't like being lied to. And so an argument, I think, can be made that, you know, the debriefing caused the harm, because if we had just stopped the experiment there, everyone would have been,
happy. You laugh, but there is a famous paper advancing precisely this view written by Marcus Jacobson and the director of his IRB at Indiana at the time, advancing exactly this argument for a phishing experiment, that the reason for not doing disclosure in phishing experiments is that they create the vast majority of the harm.
So the fact that they were irate should give you a clue that perhaps you were doing something that they didn't like.
No, I mean, the emails just said that they didn't like the fact that we lied about what the experiment was.
I understand that's what deception means, right? This is my whole point, which is why deception studies are dealt with very, very carefully, because it means that you abdicate, somebody else abdicated your right to participate in the study oftentimes.
So on that note, I think I better cut this off. I want to thank Rahul and all the panelists for a very interesting discussion.